Hey Satya, welcome to Startup Project.
Yeah, thank you, Natraj. Excited to do the podcast.
We've known each other for a while. We met at this dinner that Martin hosted, which was quite an interesting dinner, I have to say. We had some very interesting people in that dinner, and I think only we two were Indians, if I remember, and there was one other guy. Or two other people who are probably like CEOs of ex-CEOs. It was a great dinner, and you know, ever since that, I've been following SciSpot and the interesting work you're doing here. So I thought it'd be a good conversation to have on the podcast to have you on and talk about your experience. Just to set the stage, can you start with what's your background? Where did you grow up, and how did you sort of get into tech?
Yeah, for sure. I think the dinner that you mentioned was definitely really insightful. I met some really interesting people who have kind of built businesses over the last few decades and shared some of their lessons learned as well. In terms of like my background, I grew up in Agra in India, which is also known as the city of Taj Mahal. I always had an option to come to the UK because my grandfather was like part of the British government services when British were in India. So moved to UK really young, and most of my career journey has been in the UK, but obviously currently I'm based out of Seattle. My passion has always been like data right from the beginning. And I guess it stemmed from like, it's a funny story, but I'll share it. It stemmed from like learning numerology when I was 12 years old. And I learned a sign language where I converted every alphabet into a number. Even now, like when I see alphabets, I'm just like converting that into numbers. So that kind of drove my passion for like numbers, if you will. And that's how I got into data. And started my journey with Virgin Atlantic, worked for Lotus Formula One, worked for consulting, oil and gas, also did my shoe business in London. So did a fashion startup. And then worked for Discovery Channel, Eurosport Player, doing data engineering, data science work, product. And then landed in Expedia in Seattle. And so that's been kind of my journey before SciSpot, if you will.
Tell me a little bit more about Jackson, right? This was your startup. What were you doing with that?
Yeah, so I love boots, men's boots. And I used to design boots in my spare time. And at the time, I was working for Hotels.com, leading their growth marketing team. So I had a really good idea on like how search engine marketing works, how search engine optimization works. So I've got some connections in India with a shoe factory because, I mean, my whole of my family is in business. My dad, we're three brothers, all of us are in business. So I had that itch to like start something in shoes. So I started Jackson.co.uk. And kept it simple to begin with, like B2C with a website, running a lot of campaigns. And I was selling like 20 pairs of shoes a day, which is not a lot. But for me, like starting from scratch, that was quite a lot. And then I kind of reached out to mom and pop shops up and down the country in England and Scotland and started selling B2B shoes as well. And I pretty much designed all of the shoes. And the audience that I was targeting was like 40 to 60 year olds who look for comfortable shoes, but still want to like have stylish boots in the UK. So it was quite successful, but I ran into like supply chain issues. I didn't realize that certain sizes would sell out sooner than later. Should have run a data science model based on the survey, but lesson learned, and basically sold that business. But it was amazing. Like I ran it for 3.5 years and I loved every part of it.
Was it a good exit for you, or what was the exit like?
It was a good exit. So I sold it to like an existing company in the UK, which also bought my stock that I had. So it was a good exit. It wasn't like anything like what you would have in a Silicon Valley exit, but for like a mom and pop business, it was a really good exit. So I got a lot of savings out of selling that business.
Nice. So you moved to the US because of Expedia?
Yes, so Expedia kind of promoted me to a director position. So that position was in Seattle. So they moved me from London to Seattle to lead their platform team, so security and data platform team. So that experience was like really good because obviously I was working with the US folks, but still there was a slight change in culture compared to like what the London working environment is, but I thoroughly enjoyed leading a team of like security engineers and data product folks.
Got it. So at what point you made this transition? I mean, you have a nice cushy job in Expedia. I'm assuming it's cushy. But at some point you said, you know, this is enough, and you started SizePart. Or why that transition, and how did that happen?
Yeah, great question. So we're three brothers. I'm the oldest, although I would say I'm the youngest, but I'm the oldest of all three. And the middle one's already doing his business. And the youngest one at the time was working for an AI, lab-based AI company in Germany, in Berlin. And he spoke with like 300 life science companies as he was commercializing their efforts. And one thing he realized was there's a huge gap in the market when it comes to data products for life sciences. So he moved to Canada, started SizePart. At the time, I was working for Expedia. So he pitched the idea to me, my brother. And the reason I like jumped with the idea was, A, like I've done business with this brother. Growing up, we used to like handle our dad's hotel business in Agra. So we kind of did business together. So I knew his skill set and had, you know, like working with brothers can be hard. But for us, it was just like we've done this all our life. So it's kind of natural to us. So I loved the idea. And it was hard to explain to my family, my wife, like going from a really high paying job to like starting a business. But after explaining the reason, she was also bought into it. So I kind of left my job, started SizePart, and then luckily got into Y Combinator the next month. And then we never looked backwards. It's been a great story so far. We grew right from the first month, even without product. We had a customer, you know, who helped us develop the product. And since then, we've kind of grown quite a lot.
So what was the pitch to YC when, you know, I think it all happened pretty fast, right? Your brother pitching to you and you convincing your family and then joining YC. So what was the pitch to YC when you were first trying?
It's funny, like at that point in time, our pitch was slightly different to what we ended up building. At that point in time, we wanted to build a conversational platform because I was actually like working with an Expedia with the conversational platform and building security protocols around it. And LLMs weren't like, as famous as they are right now, but our initial idea was like Cybot AI, which basically like helps you find samples using voice, you know, using AI within the lab. That was our like initial pitch, but then that evolved. We pivoted and we got feedback from YC partners. I think we were ahead of our time, essentially. I think now we kind of get into the conversational part of it really easily, but what kind of resonated with our customers were like data orchestration, the data platform, connecting the data from instruments, thinking of data as a product because a lot of experiment data is unstructured. So building like an unstructured data lake that connects the experiment metadata with instruments. So we got clear signals from the market, and that's how kind of we developed SizePart.
So what was the exact problem right now SizePart solves for biotech companies or life science companies?
Yeah, so the main problem is that 80% of biotech data never gets analyzed. And there are various reasons for that. One is like, you would be surprised, a lot of labs are still paper-based. Like in 2024, there are paper-based labs. It doesn't make sense, but there is. Even like some of the enterprise companies have some of their processes in paper. And the second reason why 80% of the data never gets analyzed is, the file format and the sources of data is like quite unique in biotech. For example, you might be working with an instrument that has binary files and no kind of horizontal product would be able to like interpret those files. You know, even with foundation models, the accuracy might not be great. And then the third reason we've seen is within the lab, there are a lot of handshakes that happen, you know, so there are like very like technical wet lab teams, the very technical dry lab teams, who uses orthogonal tool sets, and they don't like do like handshakes within one platform. So because of those three reasons, as we did the market research 3 years ago, we found that 80% of the data is like not even like utilized at all. So that was like the impetus to start SizePart, that how can we help these labs not just like connect the dots, but reduce the noise to signal ratio as we connect different data points from instrument to experiment, connecting the wet lab to dry lab, for example.
So are you a vertical sort of SaaS solution to labs?
That's correct. So we're a vertical SaaS solution for biotech, R&D, manufacturing, quality, different types of lab-based businesses. And what we're seeing is like biotech will be the largest producer of data, even surpassing astronomical data by 2025. So that's the trend we're betting on, because we want to make sure we help these companies, especially modern biotech companies, to be able to utilize the power of LLMs. And I think often there's a lot of glamour around foundation models and LLMs, but people don't really talk about the grunt work behind the scenes that can help you leverage those models.
I mean, I just want to go a little bit back to YC. How was the YC experience, and sort of what were the big takeaways of that experience for you guys?
Yeah, so it was YC Summer 21, and it was all like COVID. Everything was remote. So it was like a very interesting and unique experience, I would say, because we didn't get to like go to SF, meet our partners in person. So it was pros and cons. I think the cons were like we didn't have that collaborative environment where we can meet in person and learn from the folks there itself. But the pros were we learned how to operate in a remote environment completely. As building a remote company, we've been successful. So what we learned was how to build trust virtually, you know, how to like run Zoom meetings properly. I know this sounds very trivial, but we learned a lot of like soft skills during YC. But yeah, I would still prefer going back if we could have more in-person meetings. I think that would have been helpful.
Other things that, I mean, I know, I mean, YC is such a big brand name, and with, you know, Sam Altman, who used to head YC before Gary Tan, you know, it has all its positives. What are there any things that people don't understand that are really valuable about YC? Or like the things that you get out of YC that people don't, I mean, what makes really YC YC?
I would say like the biggest lesson that I learned from YC is like being very humble and open to market signals. Like a lot of founders have this kind of passion that their idea is the best idea and it will work no matter what, which I think is a good place to start with. But what YC taught us was, you know, ultimately, market dictates, you know, what the output or the outcome would be, and really listen to those market signals and not get too attached to your idea, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't think like people understand that from the outside who've not been part of YC, because our partners were like, they asked such good questions that they helped us not get too attached with the initial idea, but get attached to like the market signals, the data that we're getting, the anecdotal feedback that we're receiving. And I feel like Paul Graham essays, like if you've seen some of the essays he's written, are so good. He talks about doing things that are not scalable in the beginning, you know? And a lot of people, and like not being part of YC, always want to like build this growth model that, you know, grows exponentially, but you've got to start things that are not scalable and really understand the market signals. So I guess getting trained on that was really good during YC.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I often like see pitch decks, and whenever someone asks me, hey, is this pitch deck good or what we should do about, I always tell them, you know, your pitch deck should be your truth seeking exercise and not like what your assumptions are there, and you put that in the pitch deck.
100%.
People always try to put their own ideas into the pitch deck, but not actually, you know, look at it as, hey, this is a truth-seeking exercise, and market might have a different opinion about what you are thinking.
Do you think sometimes like going after scale kind of disrupts that truth-seeking exercise?
Going after what? Scale?
Some sort of scale or exponential growth.
I think, especially because I see a lot of pre-seed pitch decks, I think sort of people want to fit in that venture mold because they're making that pitch. So they'll make these lofty assumptions and create this whole story that might not really exist out there, or that you'll only know when you actually go through that path, right? You can only make some assumptions. So only once you go into the market, you'll really know what the truth is. So you have to be a little bit flexible in terms of I mean, in pre-seed, you know, some founders come with financials. Although, like, yeah, it's a good exercise, but we both know that it's not going to work out the way we think it is going to work out, right? Yeah, I think the loftiness for sure adds that distortion. But I think the loftiness is a good excuse to be more truthful and find the really big idea than instead of going towards a small idea that you have and expanding and force fitting it into something it isn't, it is not, right? So
I agree with the big idea. I think the part that I have problem understanding is just highlighting the TAM, because best founders have created their own TAM.
Yeah.
And we've got plenty of examples of that as well. And I feel like sometimes founders, and I've done probably the same in the beginning stages, is like we get over-indexed on like how big is the market, you know? And I feel like as you get market signals, you can define your market that is eligible for venture funding, you know?
Yeah. And it's also like TAM is just, I always tell people that it's just a Boolean signal. Is it a yes or no? Is it big enough or not? It doesn't matter really exactly what number it is. Like, is this big enough opportunity to pursue or not? That's the only question that TAM slide should really address. Nothing more than that. But coming to size part, you said you already had a customer going, within a month or before you had the product. So how did that happen? And how did like those first 5 to 10 customers came to size part?
Yeah, so my brother has always been in the life science industry, so he already had some social capital built in, which helped.
What was he doing there in life sciences?
So he commercialized life science software companies and was the head of growth and head of marketing. So he worked for scientists in San Diego, Science Exchange in the Bay Area, LabTwin in Berlin in Europe. So all of his career has been working for life science software companies, and he understood the market really well. Plus, like, also really figuring out who our ICP is in the beginning based on the market signals we got. So we went after them, understood what they're looking for. We did some podcast as well in the beginning with, like, biotech CEOs. And some of our, like, initial angel investors were, like, from biotech. So all of that kind of helped us honed down into finding a few collaborative partners even before we had the product. And that helped us kind of build SizePort and, you know, where we are right now.
So right now, what does the traction look like at SizePort?
Yeah, so we're growing quite fast over the last 3 years. We have like startups, scale-up, enterprise customers, some public biotech companies as well. Got customers in North America, Europe, Africa, Southeast Asia. So yeah, grown up quite a lot since then. Initially, we were like focusing on R&D type companies, but now we support different companies within the lab-based businesses, from manufacturing to quality to R&D, production, and all of them kind of leverage SizePort to connect their data, whether that's instrument data to experiment metadata to results data, all in one place. It's almost like coming back to like science in one spot, SizePort. Mm-hmm. So yeah, grown quite a lot since then. And our focus now is leveraging like AI, not as like a wrapper that, you know, I hate building ChatGPT wrappers, but my focus is like how we can like make it more like agent-based. So essentially science is hard. Science has more variables than traditional tech, for example. So one of the things I'm really excited about is how can we build different agents that can delegate tasks to each other? So for example, one agent that brings data from instrument and really understand the context of lab instrument data, like let's say qPCR data. Then one instrument that understands experiment metadata. And these two can talk to each other autonomously with some human feedback. It's almost like building a future smart app, which I think is where the industry will head, where you have a bunch of agents talking to each other. Obviously, there's human in the loop. But because science has so many variables, I think this could be hugely impactful.
Yeah, I keep saying this line now that, you know, we don't have to talk to each other. My AI will chat with your AI and we all can go and sit in a beach somewhere. So I guess we'll reach that point. But talking about AI, I mean, before even that, I think if you're dealing with a lot of unstructured data, I think that's sort of like a very, very sweet spot to be in any sector that you are right now. And to clarify, like the difference between unstructured and structured is all the data that you put in databases, and unstructured is pretty much all the data that, that is in the form of files, essentially. And I deal with unstructured data on a database basis because Azure Files is an unstructured storage platform. But I feel like you are really at the cutting edge. If you store all the unstructured data in licenses at one place, then you become really valuable as a company or a product, right?
Yeah, our goal is to help biotech companies build their own IP. Like that's our goal. So it's almost like us not capturing the data, but be the staging lakehouse that our customer use to build their own IP. That's more of a goal, right? So unlike competitors in this field who wants to build like a single source of truth, that's not what we aspire to be. What we aspire to be and what the reason we've been successful with modern biotech companies is we provide the tooling for these data science focused biotech labs to be able to build their own IP. So for example, you talked about unstructured data, and with foundation model, I think it has become really easy to build an unstructured data lake with embeddings and vectorizing and entity recognition of some of that data that you get from like different sources, whether that's experiment protocols or instruments. So our goal is to make these labs successful by bridging the wet lab and dry lab gaps so they can also build their own IP as they gear towards like filing a patent, or they gear towards building a platform for drug discovery or whatever workflow they're working on.
Got it. Yeah, I think you're almost describing Databricks like a platform, but for modern biotech.
That's right.
Right. So, I mean, you've raised, I think, a couple of funding rounds. How has that journey been? Like, I know, like, YC round might be pretty straightforward. Like, once, YC accepts, you're obviously guaranteed one round. And post YC, how has it been? Talk to me a little bit about how the funding scene has been in, biotech software.
Yeah, it's been really good. I think one of the things that has helped us is we were profitable after year first and has been like break-even / profitable depending on how quickly we keep adding team members to our team. So being profitable has helped us secure funding even in the last year climate when the climate wasn't good. And our goal has been to be default alive, as YC says. So always being like focused on, irrespective of the funding environment, have a runway which is infinite, if you will, and really making sure our fundamentals are correct. Because one thing I learned during YC days is there's no correlation between funding and company being successful, So YC did this analysis and it was like quite mind-blowing to see, like there's no correlation. You could be raising
hardest raising, yeah.
Exactly. So our goal was to right from the beginning, how can we build a really fundamental business that understands, like build something that customer needs rather than what I would call like a CISP business, like solution in search of the problem. So I think that has helped a lot. And funding hasn't been our metric that we ever optimized for. What we've optimized right from the beginning is like happy customers, can we create a success story with this customer? And if that's a fit, then we work with that customer. So we've been very picky as well in terms of onboarding customers and, creating case studies with them.
Got it. And how long does it take? I mean, talk to me a little bit about your approach on getting a new customer, and how long does it take from, reaching out to a customer to onboarding them to as a customer officially?
Yeah, so I lead product and tech. My co-founder and CEO and his team handles sales and marketing. But at a high level, we have a lot of inbound, so that drives a lot of growth for us. Referrals and inbound from our existing customers who kind of get us more customers through word of mouth. Plus marketing, most of our channels has been organic so far. So we've had a lot of organic growth. We're also rated as the easiest way in terms of UI, UX of using a platform within this industry from G2. So we were ranked number one from our customers in the last quarter. So that has also kind of helped in terms of the inbounds. And in terms of like onboarding the customer, depending on the stage of the company, it can take anywhere from like 2 to 6 weeks because a lot of companies are like work in regulated environment. Compliance is really important, what we call like GxP control environment. So 2 to 6 weeks is, I would say, like from the day one to getting the customer onboarded, which is the lead cycle time is very less compared to like other competitors in the industry. And the reason we've been successful at reducing that cycle times is how we build the platform, because most of the biotech software companies started as like data management platforms, right? We started as like data orchestration, and how can we orchestrate different workflows without introducing tech debt within the platform, right? Because we are lucky that when we started, we had that technology, right? If you started a similar company solving a similar problem, let's say 10, 12 years ago, and the volume of data wasn't very high, it was all about digitization, right? I feel like digitization problem slowly going away, although it hasn't completely gone away. And the focus now is like, how can I like orchestrate the platform, build workflows on top of it based on my specific needs, based on like drug discovery or whatever research that I'm doing or manufacturing I'm doing within the lab-based businesses.
You were doing product at Expedia, right? So how did that help in what you're doing, in product development at SciSpot?
Yeah, so I think in travel tech, margins are really low compared to the life sciences or bio industry. And as a direct result of that, even competitors kind of share API details and collaborate. So one thing I learned in travel tech leading product was there's a lot of like openness in the ecosystem. For example, there's hotels.com API, there's Trivago, there's TripAdvisor, and everybody kind of bids on their specific cost per click model to understand where they are in the business and then share profits depending on if I'm bidding on business travelers versus family travelers. And I feel like bio or life sciences is still far away from that model. One thing that I would love to see is my experience in like data products and APIs helping the ecosystem in bio and life sciences to be a little bit more open. I know in the regulated industry, compliance is the biggest reason, which makes sense. And but having said that, you can also securely collaborate with indirect competitors or do more partnerships that can help not just from a profitability standpoint, but also in terms of the long-term goals, whether that's bringing drug to market or whether that's launching some product in the market, if you're manufacturing proteins, for instance. So I would love to kind of have more API, secure APIs to build that partner ecosystem in bio. But how that helped directly is from a data perspective, I did feel like I've gone back 20 years though, in terms of the data products I've seen, but that makes me more excited because I feel like SciSpot can have a huge impact in terms of building data products in the industry.
One of the challenges I hear when you're doing early stage is, especially when you have a continuous stream of new customers, is how to prioritize what you build next. Because, customers have one-off asks. That sort of puts a challenge in terms of what you're going to build next. So how do you, do you have a framework that you sort of think about on what you're prioritizing? And because you have to both balance new customers and also balance growth and then balance business priorities. Give me your thought process around that.
So that's a harder problem to solve. I won't say it's an easy problem. We battle that on a daily basis. But one thing that has helped me is I had to unlearn some of the things I learned in a bigger company. So I worked in both startups and bigger companies before SciSpot. And the bigger companies taught me like a framework of effort versus value, having a business outcome. And I feel like some of that doesn't apply in startups. Meaning it's not always effort versus value. It has to tie with your ICP, what kind of persona you're targeting. So we have a repeatable sales cycle. So we understand at least for the next 2 years, what kind of persona we are targeting. so we can set up the company, the customers for success, and have a really good case study with them. And based off of that, the top-down approach is to prioritize the features because it aligns with our roadmap, and plus it would help us, you know, create a good success story with our customer. So that's like one kind of signal that goes into the roadmap. But it's still very challenging because tactically that could still not fit into your effort versus value framework, right? Because some of the value might be higher, but effort might be higher too. So the other signal that we put in is making sure there's no technical debt as we are building a platform. There's always some technical debt, but it has to be very minimal as you build your platform, because if you do things right, your growth might not be exponential, might be linear, but what that would help you do is when suddenly you explode, your platform would be ready for it, right? So we've always had that approach of like the orchestration and having technical debt almost zero from the beginning. So that also drives the roadmap. And the third signal that I have is the security and the infrastructure. So I led the security team and, you know, understanding like SOC 2, HIPAA, and all of those controls was fairly easy for me coming from a security background. So making sure that whatever infrastructure we built so far, it's easy to like satisfy all the controls in real time. Does that make sense? So like it's not purely versus value, but it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I want to ask, how do you see Sizepart part in the next couple of years, you know, in the short term, 1 or 2 years versus, you know, maybe in 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, in the next couple of years, like our focus is to be the staging lakehouse. So how we're currently helping customers is irrespective of what tooling they use, we fit into their stack in an interoperable way, just like a middleware. So they can connect with their existing tooling stack because there's a lot of tool fatigue and we don't push our customers to have, hey, Sizepart is like your one source of truth or Microsoft for bio. That's not our approach. Our approach is to be that middleware for two reasons. One is so they can build their own IP and leverage some of the foundation models. And second reason is so they can be more compliant and have a chain of custody for all of their data, meaning the handshakes they do from like instruments to wet lab to dry lab to results to reporting it to FDA or preparing like compliance reports. So those are the main outcomes that we're targeting in the next couple of years. Long term, our goal is to like, let's say if any of these companies want to build IP and file a patent or build their own graph databases or ontologies. So in biotech, there's this term that is quite famous called ontologies because everything is so like many to many connections. Think of a sample. You might derive like aliquots or derivatives from that sample. Then you might connect results to it. Then you might have some deviations. So you're doing same thing over and over again with some protocol deviations. So building ontologies or building a knowledge graph, so every company can kind of build their own AI knowledge graph using Sizepart API or Sizepart graph databases that can then be part of their IP is what our long-term goal is, essentially.
So we are almost at the end of the conversation and pretty much all the guests, I asked some common questions. So before getting into the audience questions, I want to ask those with you. What are some of the favorite books that you read or are reading right now?
Yeah, so like I read 0 to 1, which kind of taught me, you know, how to think of a startup going from 0 to 1. And also like I've worked in startups and in bigger companies. So I've gone from 1 to N. But there's like a really different skill set that's required from going from 0 to 1. Then I've also read a lot of things from Paul Graham online that also helped me think more strategically. Peter Thiel has also been another kind of, you know, thinker that has influenced me over the last few years. And then recently, like read a lot about network effects. This book from Andrew, I forgot the name, but it talks about like how a startup builds network effects without having a network, you know?
Is this Andrew Chen from HSBC?
Yeah. Do you remember the name of the book? But I've read that book like 6 months
ago. I started reading it. I think I was in midway and I stopped. I mean, it sort of went away, but yeah. I remember that book.
Awesome. So I love that book as well. And then I'm also reading a lot of books in the bio domain. So I come from the data background. My brother is a molecular biologist. So I'm learning a lot. Like one of the studies from McKinsey states that a lot of businesses would become lab-based businesses in 10 years. Like we will be manufacturing a lot of different things in labs, right? And what is that trend, and how will that change humanity? So I'm reading a lot about that and learning as well, because there's a lot to learn in the bio domain. And what kind of keeps me going there is we've made a lot of progress when it comes to like digitalization or AI, for instance, but we've not made much progress when it comes to understanding nature and the variables. Like, you know, there's so many variables in nature. It's like thousands of years of history or models that have evolved over thousands of years, which so that part really kind of fascinates me.
Yeah, I mean, to actually, Kevin Scott, who's the CTO of Microsoft, in his strategy or sort of AI prediction for the next couple of years, what he stated was AI being used in biotech to invent new things is going to be a big trend, and how it would also increase the need for computation, and at the same time, the time required to do these innovations will be reduced. So I think it's overall an exciting trend to watch.
100%.
If you're an, you know, if you're just starting out of college and pursuing entrepreneurship, what would you advise them?
I would say we need more data and product folks joining biotech and bio industry in general. If the trend excites you, would totally encourage to kind of consider biology as well, even if you don't have any background in biology, because sometimes bringing the outer perspective can really help. You know, I mean, you do need experts, but I feel like coming from outside, you can bring fresh perspective. Second thing I would say, like entrepreneurship is going to get more and more easier because building it is getting easier. So last 10 years, people have, at least most intelligent people have like gone towards big tech, which is okay. Nothing's right or wrong, but I feel like we need more individuals, smart individuals building businesses, and it would only get easier, and the friction and the barrier to entry is reducing. You know, it's disrupting not just how you develop the product, but it's changing the VC model too. And I feel like it would become easier for 10 people company to build a billion-dollar business in the next 5 to 10 years. You don't need like hundreds of people, for instance.
Yeah, I completely believe that. I think it's also like entrepreneurship in the developed world is a lot of it is de-risked. I think people see entrepreneurship, especially like when I talk to founders coming from big tech to startups, they think it is a very big risk. But if you plan it accordingly and strategize, I think it can be de-risked. And the system itself is already de-risking a lot of things for you. I think you need to put obviously some right pieces in the place, but I think there's a lot of de-risking that happened in the last decade.
Absolutely. Totally agree with you. And I think sometimes founders have to detach from the original idea to be successful too. Because let the market signals dictate, because ultimately, why are you building the company? You want to make somebody happy, right? So it's the customers that you want to make happy. So you want to solve the right problem for them.
Are there any mentors that, you know, that you follow or, you know, who shape your career?
Yeah, so I worked with John Kim at Expedia, who's also an investor in SciSpot. He's been an amazing guidance in terms of like building data products. He's taught me about growth mindset and how to like what metrics to optimize for as you're building a product that is loved by your users and customers. So learned a lot from him. And then like various folks that I can't name in the short amount of time who have shaped my career over the last decade or so. I'm also inspired by my brother, who's the co-founder. He's done amazing work in, you know, biology and life sciences in general. And then the customers I work with, some of the work they're doing is almost like science fiction to me, which I can't even talk about in the podcast, but it's amazing. You know, when I see SciSpot being used in such companies, it just, that's what like, keeps me like waking up every morning and I keep going essentially.
Oh, I forgot to ask you one question, that how is it building a company in Seattle?
It's been like, so I've lived in India, UK, and US, and I've also worked in Australia, Europe, Qatar, US, India, various countries. I've worked in like 8 countries in various short stints. And I feel like US has been amazing in terms of the mentorship and the VCs and the guidance you get and the network of Y Combinator as well. And the only comparison I have is like comparing the London ecosystem with the Seattle, but I know like San Francisco has got a better support network than Seattle for sure. But I feel like Seattle's definitely growing and much better than the London startup ecosystem, at least based on anecdotal data and seeing the network in these two countries. I think London's really, it's getting better and it's quite good in fintech, but I think in the field that I am in bio and life sciences, Seattle is growing. And in a few years, I hope that it becomes more like the Boston and the SF ecosystem. You know, I think the right players are coming in, but it still has a long way to go to, you know, become a hub for biotech and big pharma in general.
If you had to change one or two things to make Seattle ecosystem better, what would that be?
I would say like better network, whether that's for YC and founders. So for instance, we do have a good YC network. We meet biweekly in Seattle, and that has helped me a lot. But we need a bigger network that I think is missing in Seattle. Mm-hmm. We need more VCs to come in, which is a no-brainer, right? There's so many smart people working for AWS, Microsoft, Expedia, you know, Salesforce, a few other companies. So we should have a bigger network of VCs and even angels. Like these folks can become part of the angel network. And I think having more, and then the UW network, University of Washington, so many talented folks, right? And
yeah.
And I don't know what's the missing factor yet, why that network hasn't grown as much as like SF or even New York, I feel like, you know. So, yeah, it's hard to know what that one reason. Do you know, like, what would you say, like, is that one kind of secret sauce that has built networks better in New York and San Francisco?
I think it's just scaling up everything we have, I would say. I think we have all sort of pieces in a smaller scale. I think we just have to, you know, scale that up. And I think it starts with more investors sort of putting Seattle as their second focus area. I think we've seen recently Techstars closed its Seattle shop, which which doesn't make any sense on paper because they've hired like 3 unicorns. And I mean, I met some of the best entrepreneurs in the Techstar meetings. I don't know if they invested in those, but Techstars allows you to get those, like I've invested in 2 AI companies, which are really extremely smart people. I've met both in one of the Techstars meetings. So I don't know why they closed it out, because they have access to these founders, right? So it's a matter of you whether investing or not. So, but I would say it's just scaling up of things. I think we need to attract more investors of different fields, like you mentioned. I think cloud and B2B is big, but consumer is less, and biosciences is much lesser, I would think. So I think it's just, we have to scale things up.
100%. And I love what like Pack Ventures and Breakwater are doing in the Seattle Pacific Northwest. And I think you're right. We need more VC players and a better ecosystem. I also like what Creative Destruction Lab is doing in Seattle. I think that would also help. And also the YC network is growing in this region as well.
Yeah. So we have one audience question from Amrita. The question is, how was your marketing experience? Does being a YC startup help? Are companies welcoming to startups and sharing their data? So it's sort of like two questions.
So marketing experience, I think as you're starting off, obviously it's harder to build the trust. And I think what helped is the YC network and making our initial set of customers really happy and then grew from there. In terms of marketing, what also helped was not being fluffy and really doing scientific marketing for us. So both the founders are technical, me and my other co-founders, and we've always focused on, because our customers are like scientists, both wet lab scientists and computational biologists. They're very smart people, they're researchers, and I think the marketing that resonates with them is also more like white paper, consultative, technical marketing, science-based. So that has helped a lot of understanding our audience. And in terms of like building the trust, so I think we built our platform secure by design, and having security and compliance control right from the beginning really helped us build that trust with our customers, because a lot of what we do is essentially connecting their data. So security is really important for us. The other thing that has helped over the years is hiring really good talent. You know, SciSpotters, as we call them, SciSpotters attracted a really good talent pool from University of Waterloo in Kitchener-Waterloo in Canada, and also University of Washington. So we have the best of both worlds on the East Coast and the West Coast, as a lot of our team members are on the East side, who've graduated from University of Waterloo or done PhD there, and me being plugged into Seattle network has helped as well.
Awesome. That's the only question we have from audience. Satya, thanks for joining and coming onto the show and sharing all your insights and your journey, and looking forward to meeting you in another event.
Brilliant, Natraj, and thank you for all the questions. If I can help define the founder ecosystem here or answer any questions for one of you, an entrepreneur, happy to support the Pacific Northwest region.
Thanks, Satya.